Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. Truth is, politics isn't really about politics. You know, it's just economics by other means. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, today, the 6th day of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. One hates to be presumptuous, but the big global political story of the day, the G20 summit over in Hamburg and the street protests that are happening alongside, really, that's all about economics, about global trade, about who's getting and who's not. It's not so much about handshakes and bilateral meetings. So to that end, we here begin today with news from the Commerce Department this morning that the trade deficit, the difference between what we sell overseas and what we import, and, by the way, one of President Trump's favorite, if misused, economic metrics, fell last month. More than any policy move from the White House, though, Marketplace's Andy Euler reports that a smaller trade gap is likely due to the weakening dollar, which could bring with it some broader economic implications.
2017's been a bummer for the dollar. According to the U.S. dollar index, it's dropped almost 5% in 3 months. But President Trump supports a weaker dollar because it makes the things that U.S. multinationals export more competitive overseas.
It is true that that actually helps exporters.
Campbell Harvey teaches finance at Duke. He says that could help shrink the trade deficit, which was down 2% in May. Narrowing the trade gap is something of a mission for President Trump. So weak dollar, more exports? Have we entered the Trump economy? Not quite.
It's naive to say, well, this depreciation is going to help the U.S., or this is a sign of weakness. Basic fluctuation in exchange rates is something that's normal.
Not only that, but Patrick Newport, an economist at IHS Markit, says the dollar's just getting back to normal.
The exchange rate shot up after the election, and now it's pretty much back to where it was before the election.
Interest rates shot up because investors were told to expect tax overhaul, deregulation, and fiscal stimulus. But that hasn't happened. Also remember, when the dollar weakens, imports are more expensive. That lowers American consumers' purchasing power. Richard Bernstein runs his own financial advising firm.
Consumption is 70% of the U.S. economy, roughly. So whenever you set an economic policy, whether it's respect to the dollar or taxes or anything, first and foremost, you have to look at the impact on the basic consumer.
Patrick Newport at IHS Markit says it's going to take a lot more than a sluggish dollar to close that trade gap.
The trade deficit is going to shrink. It has to come from either higher taxes or reduced spending, or it could come from consumers consuming less.
Well beyond basic fluctuation, that would take a total shift in American economic behavior. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Elsewhere in the international movement of goods and services, Japan and the European Union announced a trade deal today covering 10% of the world's population and 40% or so of global trade, which got us thinking about the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP, our proposed free trade agreement with the European Union. Yeah, it kind of got lost in that whole us pulling out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership thing, didn't it? We sent Marketplace's Ryan Kailath to find out what's going on.
Depending who you ask, the U.S. trade agreement with Europe is either dead in the water or buried in a deep, deep freeze.
Nobody wants to say this thing is over, but Trump's America First policies, his insults to Germany, make it really hard to imagine how negotiations could go.
Carolyn Freund of the Peterson Institute says classic trade deals are about cutting tariffs, making trade cheaper. But tariffs between the U.S. and Europe are already pretty low. The big innovation of TTIP, she says, was on product regulations.
If you've ever driven a car in Europe, you probably didn't really notice very many differences.
But there are tons of different little safety rules, she says, about window thickness or the placement of lights.
This means that producers have to produce two of each model, a Ford Fusion for the U.S. and a Ford Fusion for Europe.
TTIP would have solved this problem, not just for cars, but pharmaceuticals, machinery, and a bunch of other industries. But talks started to fall apart over food safety standards. Then came the election of trade deal bashing President Trump.
Trump's position on trade has made it easier for the Europeans to do deals with other countries.
Edward Alden of the Council on Foreign Relations says on trade deals, the U.S. has always been the belle of the ball. But if we don't want to dance with Europe,
they're going to go find other partners to dance with. They're dancing with the Japanese. They're going to dance with the Indians and the Chinese.
This is what makes the EU-Japan deal signed today so interesting, Alden says, and such a long-term threat to the U.S.
Either the United States is busy writing the rules for the next generation of global commerce, or you get out the way Trump wants to do, and you quickly become irrelevant.
Passing TTIP would be tough under a trade-friendly president. Under Trump, it might be nearly impossible. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
Wall Street today? Nope, not even close. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. In antiquities news today, cuneiform tablets and clay bullae. Federal prosecutors in Brooklyn say the craft store Hobby Lobby and its owners, the Green family, illegally smuggled thousands of questionably obtained ancient artifacts into the country. Emma Green, no relation we should say, covers politics and policy and religion for The Atlantic magazine. Thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Remind us, would you, who the Green family is, what Hobby Lobby is, and why they would want 3,450 cuneiform tablets and other stuff.
So typically you'd go into Hobby Lobby not because you're seeking out ancient antiquities from Iraq, but because you want some craft supplies and glitter. It's a major craft store supply chain that's around the United States. The Green family owns it. But since about 2009, Hobby Lobby has been investing in its antiquities collection. And this tends to be around Christian artifacts. They're evangelical Christians, and they collect Bibles and other kinds of Christian artifacts from ancient times. This case centers around something a little bit different. These are cuneiform tablets that are from modern-day Iraq, and they just generally fit into the Green family's interest in antiquities.
The catch here, as you say in your piece in The Atlantic about this case, is that the provenance of these pieces, their origin is, and this is your word, muddy.
This is the key, tracing the provenance, making sure that the supply of this object going from year to year to year was always transferred in a legal way, was never stolen or smuggled or sort of smudged and covered. And what happened here is that the Green family, Hobby Lobby, was trying to engage with a set of dealers who issued a certificate of provenance that appears to be kind of dodgy. There's a lot of unclearness about how they actually came to be in the United States when they were and what their origin actually is.
Can we detour here for a second to how they might have been removed from Iraq and that region in the first place, and who might be profiting from this sale? I mean, it was $1.5 million.
It's a huge sale. And moreover, these kinds of objects are really priceless. They have been looted consistently from places like Iraq, but especially Iraq. In recent years, this has become even more high pressure and had a lot of law enforcement scrutiny on it because groups like ISIS have been looting cultural sites and selling artifacts in part to finance their military efforts.
The company and the Green family have apologized. They have made restitution. They have surrendered these objects. But it bears a mention here that as they were being imported, and part of the reason the feds caught on to this is that they were marked as samples of imported things for the Green family. And there were a disparate number of suppliers used to conceivably, again, here's the word, muddy the tracks of where the stuff came from.
As the complaint noted, there's a lot of techniques that people will use when they're trying to evade inspections by customs. And what the dealers did in this case were, first, as you mentioned, falsely label the packages. They falsely put the origin in Turkey when that was not the case. And they sent the packages to multiple different shipping addresses to give the illusion that it was being sent to multiple different buyers. All of these are some of the hallmarks and red flags of smuggling operations.
What happens now to these artifacts? Do they get sent back to Iraq? Do they go into some federal warehouse here, like Raiders of the Lost Ark or whatever? I mean, what happens?
So this is a civil forfeiture case, meaning the United States government has taken up these artifacts and objects. I assume there will be some sort of effort to try to return them to their original and rightful owner, but that in itself can be really complicated. Yeah. But meanwhile, one of my favorite things about this is that in civil forfeiture cases, the title of the case is actually named for the objects that are being forfeited. So this case is called, appropriately, the United States of America versus approximately 450 ancient cuneiform tablets and approximately 3,000 ancient K bulle.
The law is great. Emma Green, she covers politics, policy, and religion for The Atlantic. Emma, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've heard, perhaps here and elsewhere, that brick-and-mortar retail has seen better days. American retailers could wind up closing more stores this year than they did in 2008 as the recession was taking hold. All of that turnover is a challenge for malls and main streets. Take just, for instance, Robertson Boulevard out on the west side of L.A., once a celebrity hotspot filled with paparazzi and high-end luxury stores. The two-block shopping district is now struggling with vacancies, as Marketplace's Aaron Schrank reports.
There are hardly any shoppers on Robertson Boulevard on a recent visit, compared to the throngs on nearby Rodeo Drive or Melrose Boulevard. Robertson is a bit of a contradiction. While there's a Chanel store selling $3,000 handbags, it's surrounded by depressing, vacant storefronts. But there are some tourists. Why did they come?
Pretty much the Ivy. We were visiting, we know about the Ivy, and we really wanted to go, so.
Samantha Young from Arizona is talking about the white picket-fenced restaurant that's been a celebrity landmark here for decades. She's surprised by what she sees on the rest of the street.
Especially being as busy of an area as it is, like, it's very noticeable when it's vacant like this.
About a third of the retail space on Robertson is vacant, a far cry from when Fraser Ross opened kitschy high-end retailer Kitson here in 2000. The store became the epicenter of L.A.'s fame culture.
The heyday was probably 2005. It was, you know, when the reality stars would come to Robertson to be photographed, and even the A-list actors would go to the Ivy and have lunch.
Lindsay Lohan famously crashed her car on Robertson after one such lunch. Crowds would gather here just to watch Paris Hilton shop. The street was full of trendy boutiques back then, but Ross says that changed beginning in 2008, just before the recession.
Big chains came to Robertson. Ralph Lauren came, Chanel. I think they came to Robertson to try to get that hip type of credibility to their brand.
Dolce & Gabbana, Lululemon, Michael Kors, Tommy Hilfiger. These brands all set up shop on Robertson, and rents skyrocketed. Jay Lux is a local real estate broker.
Robertson rents got up to Rodeo Drive numbers in 2008.
Stores that rented for $3 per square foot per month in the late 90s were going for around $30. That forced some indie retailers off the street. The hype around Robertson started to fade. Even the store that started it all, Kitson, closed down. With the surge of online shopping, luxury brands found it hard to justify their expensive storefronts. Bob Ishu has run a glasses shop on the street for more than a decade.
You know, business was thriving here. All of a sudden, just went down. And, you know, you see people, like, leaving left and right.
Many of the luxury brands shut down their Robertson stores, and some are still empty. Ralph Lauren's 11,000-square-foot boutique has been vacant for 2 years. The sky-high rents demanded by landlords have had to be rethought.
These are landlords that will admit to your face that they were wrong.
Lux says in order to attract new tenants, landlords have had to drop rents drastically. Many are now advertising space not for $30, but for $10, and some are doing deals for under $5.
Other landlords don't have that ability because they paid up for it, and they're just waiting it out to hope the rents come way back up. I don't think they'll get back to where they were.
The cheap rents are attracting new stores. In one of retail's endless cycles, Robertson could be headed towards a renaissance. A new restaurant, coffee shop, and boxing gym are coming to the street soon, things you can't do online. Fraser Ross opened a new store called Kit Ross last year, in the same space Kitson used to be. He's hung vinyl signs on the windows of the vacant building next to his.
I did it because I didn't want to look at an empty storefront anymore. It says I Heart LA, so at least people stand by here and take pictures.
Ross has been pushing for the past year for something he thinks will attract more shoppers to Robertson. Free parking. And he's been successful. The city began offering free 2-hour parking in a garage it owns on the street last week. In Los Angeles, I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
Coming up, you know, the decision is, do you do something or you just go broke?
Saving the family store with soda pop. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 158 points on this Thursday, 0.7%, 21,320. NASDAQ down 61, that is 1%, 6,089. S&P 500 down 22, 0.9%, 2409. Microsoft confirmed today it's laying off workers. The company will reportedly cut thousands of jobs. 3 and 4,000 is somewhere in that number range. Largely in sales, by the way, as part of a reorg. Microsoft clicked down 0.7% today. Retail still looking sharp. Warren L Brands, the parent company of Victoria's Secret and Bath & Body Works, reported weak sales in June. L Brands slipped off 14% today. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.36%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Picking up on Aaron's piece about the trickle-down effects of the jam that retailing finds itself in right now. One of the things that can help when this industry or that runs into trouble is size, getting bigger in a shrinking space, which gets us to the retail corporate story of the day. QVC is buying its longtime rival HSN, the Home Shopping Network, in a $2.1 billion deal. The two companies have made names for themselves with their television channels, but they do sell things online as well. And the thinking here is that this merger is going to help them get even closer to the Amazons out there. Marketplace's Rima Kreis has that one.
QVC is like a nonstop pageant of toasters, opal bracelets, and jumbo microwavable mugs.
It is food storage. You can reheat. You can cook.
QVC, which began in 1986, is what Paula Rosenblum calls the original social network.
You'd get people who were otherwise isolated in small towns who would get to get on TV and talk about products they like and share tips and information.
Over the years, QVC has shifted that network online. But last year, sales there only grew by 7%.
They're dealing with sluggish sales as Amazon rules the roof.
Howard Davidowitz is a retail analyst. He says QVC's merger with HSN will allow the company to cut down costs while growing online sales by more than $7 billion.
That will mean they are only behind Amazon and Walmart.
Stephanie Zarobin is a researcher with Internet Retailer. She says generally QVC has been an innovator when it comes to e-commerce.
They invest a ton in it. They've got pretty robust mobile apps, and they're experimenting with things like, you know, augmented reality and machine learning.
But what they don't have is a lot of younger customers. People like 29-year-old Mandy Moss from Pennsylvania, who just bought a tunic and cardigan.
QVC shows me items that I didn't know I wanted until I saw it on either online, on the app.
QVC is banking on more Mandy's as baby boomers get older and spend less. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
All right, here we are. Galcos. Every now and then, kind of against the odds, actually, given how fast this economy is changing, you stumble across a business that feels a little bit like it's from a time gone by.
This looks like an old-timey shop, man. It's great.
A business that's found a way to survive in an economy that's just a whole lot different than it used to be.
Wow. Hi, how are you? I'm Kai.
I'm John.
Nice to see you, John. How are you?
We're in L.A., a neighborhood called Highland Park, in Galco's Soda Pop Stop. John Neese owns the place.
Galco's actually started downtown.
Yeah.
And my father moved the business up here in 55 when they cut the Hill Street tunnels to make the Hollywood Freeway.
I was going
to
say, you go way back.
Well, we go way back, yeah.
John's grandfather started the family business back in 1897. The store today is totally a throwback. Polished cement floors, kind of a classic look, but with aisles stocked with thousands and thousands and thousands of bottles of soda, 750 different kinds in all.
Tell me about this place now, 1955?
We moved in here in 55, and before that it was an A&P, and before that it was White's Grocery. It wasn't this large, it was half the size. I remember just concrete floors, and you'd walk around and turn every light off. You can still, if you look out there,
the light
you can still
sure.
see the plugs sure. where you would walk and turn every light off by hand.
How did it come to be that you're a soda pop store?
Well, About, we'll see, it's been about 18 years now, yeah. 19 years.
Because it was a business decision, right? I mean,
going broke. I mean, it's easy to make decisions when you're going broke. You know, the decision is, do you do something or you just go broke? Because what had happened was the distribution channels to the grocery stores were bought up by the big chain stores. And what they did is they closed the distribution channels down and reopened them at $15, $20 a case more. So what was really going on is they were the little stores up until that time were the cap on supermarket pricing. So when they destroyed the distribution channels for the little stores, there's no more cap. They can charge whatever they want. And they do charge whatever they want.
Was there a moment where you knew that you had to change stuff?
I remember thinking about beer, and I'm saying, but you have to be 21 to buy a beer. If you sell sodas, if you have the money in your hand, you can go anywhere and buy a soda. Huh. So it gives me a broader audience.
How do you find them, though? You just pick up the phone and...
Well, I'll give you an example. A lady called in. She says, I heard about you, and I'm looking for a mint soda for my Kentucky Derby party. And I said, you know, I'm sorry, I don't have any mint sodas. This is like 18 years ago. She says, well, I know where to find them. I lived in Pittsburgh. They are all over Pittsburgh. And a few weeks later, I get a call from this fellow, Paul Bowser. At Natron Bottling. And he's going,
Natron, Pennsylvania.
Hi, there's a lady out in your neck of the woods, and she wants to buy a couple of cases of my mint julep, but I don't sell cases, I sell pellets. And she said, maybe you and I, we can do some business. And so hey, I'm going to send you samples. He sent them. Oh, my goodness. It was actually made with real mint. It was absolutely delicious.
You know what's funny is that, and maybe I'm just, maybe this is false romanticism, right? But that's the way business used to be. A guy called a guy.
Yeah.
And said, listen, I got this thing.
That's exactly what happened.
Show me around a little bit. Tell me what we got.
What are you interested in?
I'm a ginger ale guy. I used to be a root beer guy.
You want to take ginger ales first, or do you want to take
Let's take ginger ales first.
Okay. This one right here.
Yeah?
This is Jamaica's Finest, the hot, 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 and the regular. These are made with ginger root oil.
Hot, 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 like spicy hot, hot, hot?
Yeah, it's spicy hot.
Extra spicy, soft.
But there's a difference.
Made with ginger root oil. All right.
It's made with root oil. That's the key. Most ginger sodas today are made with extracts and flavors. Huh. And what they do is they use caspium, the pepper, to make them hot.
Oh, yeah, which is cheating, right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's an inexpensive way of making it. 50, 60 years ago, all sodas, even 7-Up was made with lemon and lime oils and the zest. Today, it's all extracts and flavors.
Wow.
So...
There's a bunch of Dad's Root Beers. There's Bubble Up. What is Bubble Up?
We have Bubble
Kiss
Up is lemon and
Kiss
lime.
Lime.
Oh, yeah. There's a story for everything.
You're saying that like I should know it. I've never heard of Bubble Up in
You've
my
never
life.
Heard of Bubble Up?
No.
Okay. Well, it's older than 7-Up. That's 1921 Sandusky, Ohio. Yeah. And 7-Up didn't come out until 29.
Well, look, there is actually Coca-Cola. You have Coca-Cola here.
Yeah. Those are the
cane sugar ones?
Mm.
No. Sorry. What?
No, I want
You look at me like I have three heads. What?
Well, let me say this. Okay. Everybody thinks Coca-Cola coming out of Mexico is cane sugar.
Yeah, is it not? What? There's that look again.
No.
You're
no.
the soda expert. No. I don't know.
When the United States government sues the Mexican government over the right to import corn syrup into Mexico, and Mexico doesn't use corn syrup, and we win, where do you think it's going?
Right.
It's going to the Enterprise Zone. That's where it's going. So Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola, who own the bottling plants in the Enterprise Zone, they can ship them back here. It's cheaper.
You sound frustrated with the global economy.
Yes, I'm very frustrated.
Okay.
You know what real sugar, how real sugar came about? The
no.
lowercase sugar. Oh, my goodness. There was a lawsuit that was supposed to take place here in Los Angeles. It was never went to trial. It was settled, and the results were sealed. 4 months later, they came out with made with real sugar. What they did, the cane sugar people and the corn syrup people, in order to get federal subsidies, came to an agreement. What they did is they lowercase sugar and made it a generic term for any kind of a sweetener so anybody could use it. It's still corn syrup.
So when it says real sugar?
If it says real sugar, be aware, it's probably corn syrup.
And if it says cane sugar?
If it says cane sugar, it's cane sugar.
All right. Do you have kids who are going to take this over when you're gone?
My daughter's very successful in her chiropractic business. I mean, she's very good. My grandchildren, they're interested in working.
Yeah.
You know what I said, what do you want to do? We want to be the soda samplers.
Well, yeah.
And I said, no, you're going to start where everybody is supposed to start. at the bottom.
You're going to be, you're 74 years old. You're going to be in another 20 years.
Oh, probably.
John, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for coming.
I should say here, in the interests of full disclosure, that John sells beer, too, and not the fizzy yellow kind.
And we have things you're not going to find, like even this.
Oh, no, look at that.
Yeah.
Yes, no, I'm buying this. So let me just say, this is Dogfish Head 120-minute IPA, which basically you can't find
in
the state of California,
it.
But I just did, and I'm buying it. I don't even care how much it costs, but I'm going to expense it at the marketplace because it's on the job.
All right, I didn't actually make Marketplace pay. All talk, no action, I guess. This final note on the way out, in which some reading between the lines is required. Walter Schaub resigned today. Who, I hear you asking, is Walter Schaub? Until the 19th of July, the effective date of his resignation, Mr. Schaub is the head of the Office of Government Ethics and a somewhat regular and unwilling sparring partner with the Trump White House. In his letter to the president resigning, he called public service, quote, a public trust requiring employees to place loyalty to the Constitution, the laws, and ethical principles above private gain, end oh quote. Oh man, we're late. We got to go. Suffice it to say, a bad day in the markets. How about that? John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Troe are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor for the time being is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.